Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. From an acclaimed chronicler of the forces eroding America's social fabric comes her most personal work, a reckoning with the changes that have rocked her own beloved Ohio hometown. Today we'll be talking with Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Beth Macy is a Virginia-based journalist who writes about outsiders and underdogs. Raised poor in a small Ohio community, she's the award-winning author of New York Times bestselling books examining rural communities left behind by corporate greed and political indifference. Her books include Factory Man, Dopesick, and Raising Lazarus. Dopesick was made into a Peabody Award-winning series for Hulu, starring Michael Keaton. We welcome in Beth Macy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
It's a great honor for us to have you on the program as well. Fascinating previous books. I guess just may review that. Factory Man, about the hollowing out of the Rust Belt, I guess, in America from NAFTA and globalization, right? Dopesick, the opioid crisis and how that's affecting those communities. Raising Lazarus is a follow-up. What prompted this latest book? It's turned into a memoir.
Yeah, great question. I was going home to see my mother beginning in the mid-teens, who she had been diagnosed with dementia. I was going home more often. I live in Virginia. She lives in rural Ohio. And I start to notice these changes in my hometown where I haven't lived in 40 years, including a town once known as a haven for the Underground Railroad, and now there's Confederate flags flying. And how does that happen in a town that, I mean, we celebrated that. In the middle of the town square is a Union soldier with his head down facing north for victory and also in mourning for all the people our town lost. How does that happen? How is it that I'm having these conflicts within my family over politics when we never even discussed it before? And then the culminating moment was at our mother's deathbed. It happened to be the Saturday after the 2020 election when the hospice nurse announced that they were calling the election for Biden. And my evangelical sister, whom I had never really heard talk about politics before, shouted, "You wait, it's fraudulent, he won't win." And I just thought, wow, when mom's gone, what's left of the family? And so I decided a couple of years ago to start going back home and to interviewing my family and friends and really doing a deep dive about how my hometown of Urbana, Ohio had changed in the 40 years since I left it and what, if anything, remained of my family. So it's a look at Urbana as a microcosm of America and how we got so polarized.
I want to get into your childhood, Urbana back in the day, and then contrast it to today. But just on a personal level, I think you've said that you this was painful, to see your hometown, what it had become from what it was, and on a personal level, your family, right, fractures in the family, to the point where on some of these trips you would leave early from what you had planned, right?
Yeah, I would book an Airbnb for a week. I tried to go for 1 week a month. It's a 7-hour drive from my home in Roanoke, Virginia to Urbana. And sometimes I would stay with a friend or one of my sisters. But usually because I was working so much and I'd be so exhausted at the end of the day because you try to pack a lot in, right? And after a few of these visits, I would book a week at an Airbnb and then I find myself leaving for home after 4 days and, paying for time I didn't use because it was painful. And I wanted to get home to my husband and my dog and my friends that think exactly like I do, frankly.
So let's take listeners back. Paint a picture of Urbana back when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm. So we're the Urbana Hill Climbers. That's our high school team. I live in the mountains of Virginia now. The first time I took my husband back to Urbana, and I had been telling him about this hill that the high school was built on and how big it was. It's like you don't even have to accelerate to go up the hill. It's a tiny little hill. So it's, it's in the kind of prairie, rolling prairies. And it was a factory town when I was growing up, dominated largely by a company called Grimes Manufacturing, where Old Man Grimes, the man who invented the airplane light system and the navigation system on airplane lights, basically ran the town. He was mayor for a time. He was patriarchal in the good and bad senses of the way. And when the economy would tank, my mother, who worked at Grimes, she soldered airplane lights, would have to pick up under the table jobs, waitressing and babysitting. And it was a tough existence. My dad, by the time I came along in 1964, I was the youngest by far of four kids. I was like almost like an only child. And he was an unfunctioning alcoholic at that point. So my mom really was did everything for the family. She worked, she cooked, she paid the bills, she cleaned. And that was tough at times, but I had one stable parent, and I had a grandma next door who was like my own private head start, taught me how to read and write when I was four, and never refused me candy money at Kermazee's store, and spoiled me.
Your mother sounds like quite the character.
Oh my gosh.
This is a tough life, right? Dad's an alcoholic. You write that she'd have to go down to the VFW hall to make sure she got the intercepted the paycheck, right? Before he
Right, on those rare
spent
weeks,
it, yeah.
before he spent it or gambled it. And she would take me along, and I thought the VFW was kind of a cool place because you had to have a passcode and a two-way mirror to get in. And it was a little tiny whiff of Mission Impossible in a very boring little town. And if you'd caught Dad between his second and fifth beer, he was pretty friendly. But otherwise, he was hungover and he was kind of a jerk.
No, you're I got a kick out of that. You said your mother was very frugal, and you give some examples, and you say she even put you on layaway.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
I actually have the. I'll show it to you for the YouTube folks. But when I was about 25, I was leaving home, and she gave me this little payment record. How she had placed my birth on layaway, paying $5 and $10 at a time, and she was joking. She got, "Here, you owe me $110." Very frugal. When I was filling out the financial aid paperwork to go to college, she at the time was making $8,000 a year test driving cars for a Honda subcontractor. And I qualified for a full Pell Grant, which was a surprise to me. I mean, if they would have told me I could go to college for free when I was in second grade, I would have never gotten an A minus. I would have like been, "Oh, hell yeah, I'm going for this." But I was a good student and I had great teachers, and the town had a thriving middle class, so I had a lot of people pulling for me, and my friends' parents were hugely influential in my life. And I was sort of able to create a second family among my friends' parents and my teachers that encouraged me to go to college. And when I went in 1982, it was possible to get a four-year degree from a good public institution. I went to Bowling Green State University, and it was fully free because it only cost like $2,000 a year at the time. It paid tuition, room and board, books, and I even had work study jobs so I could have pizza and beer just like everyone else. And it saved my life, essentially. It put me on a track to middle class. I met my husband, whose parents were like Ozzie and Harriet compared to mine, and had a swimming pool in the backyard, suburban Indianapolis. And suddenly I was a part of this other family whose experience was totally different from mine, and that too helped me.
Yeah, you're right that in a sense, Senator Pell put you on an airplane to a better life.
That's right. He
And
did,
yeah.
and he's a multimillionaire at birth. His family owned all of Westchester County in New York, like centuries ago, right? But he cared. I mean, this is the early 70s. It's the war on poverty. And he wanted to design what he called it the GI Bill for everybody, so that everybody had a shot at a life better than the one they were born into. And just like if you look at our wealthy leaders today, nobody's talking about stuff like that. By the time Reagan comes along in the 80s, he's saying, his Secretary of Education is saying, this whole notion that college education is a portal into the middle class, is sociological flimflammery. I mean, that's bunk. I'm not sociological flimflammery. This worked for me. I had good public schools, a great K-12. I had some really influential teachers, both in public school and then at my public college. And it has made me a happy, productive citizen who now gives back. And I more than paid that money back that was given to me in spades.
So maybe setting up the contrast that we'll get into a little bit. One of the things you say is that in your hometown, many hometowns across America, everybody sat and watched Walter Cronkite, right? Everybody kind of had a unified vision. The hometown paper, and you—that's where the—that's in part where the title comes from, Paper Girl, right? You delivered the paper.
I started out helping a couple neighbor boys that I had a crush on, the Kellenberger boys, deliver their paper routes. And then when they quit, I inherited one of them. And, it was a way to buy clothes that I liked and to do things like go on the field trip to Washington, D.C., which my family couldn't afford to send me on. So I learned very early, like, work ethic and everybody in my whole neighborhood took the paper then, and we all agreed on the same sets of facts. My parents were, they weren't very educated. My dad dropped out of school in, I think, the eighth grade. My mom was a high school grad, very smart. They were great readers of the newspaper. They consumed multiple books a week, went to the library, which was down the street. I mean, even my dad, a great reader. And this is the ethos that we grew up in. And when I started writing for newspapers, like for instance, when I moved to Roanoke, Virginia to work for the Roanoke Times, which is this great newspaper at the time, had been Pulitzer finalist 3 years, scrappy, punched above its weight. We had, I mean, this is a community of about a quarter of a million readers. We had the highest penetration rate in the nation. Almost everybody took the Roanoke Times. The best penetration rate in the nation. And we had 60 some reporters covering all of Western Virginia. And as the decades went on, we closed the bureaus. And a lot of this is the result of digital and internet, like usurping Craigslist, Facebook, all this. Papers get smaller and smaller. Now the Roanoke Times has gone from 60 some reporters to six. So it's one tenth the size, and the circulation's even less than that than it once was. We have a couple of online startups, but if you read all three of those outlets, you would still get about a third of the news that you once got. And that's true across the board, with a few exceptions like the New York Times, which is killing it and growing. Local news in medium size and smaller communities is all but gone. And in my hometown, when I was a college intern for the Urbana Citizen, it was called the Urbana Daily Citizen. Now it's no longer daily. And we had about eight reporters then. Now they have one and a half, and they can't even cover city council. So people don't know what they don't know. And as someone, a civic leader at the end of the book says, in Urbana, with the middle class now hollowed out, what you have is the professional class, or what he called the country club class, because a lot of the deals in towns get made at the country club, and what he called the ghetto. And he said, neither knows what the other's up to because they don't know basic facts about their community, although they don't know that they don't know that. So when I come in and I'm pointing out the fact that in 40 years since I left, mental health emergency calls have gone up, multiplied by a factor of nine. Foster care placements have tripled in just the past decade because of the opioid crisis, and food stamps have doubled. This is all news to them. And it's news, it would be news to most of our communities. Urbana is not especially bad. This is what a small town of 11,000 people in general looks like now. And in fact, Urbana, by some metrics, is better than many because it has managed to retain some of its manufacturing.
So I guess, it kind of works both ways is kind of what you're implying. And I'm gathering from the book, from this discussion, somewhere here, you note that, you turn into the kind of the national outlets, and that news is produced by college graduates, right? Mm-hmm. And by kind of the not so much the country club set, but the professional class, right? And mm-hmm. and so maybe that's one factor why the folks in the you know, the what he called the ghetto there in Urbana are not picking up what they're putting down, right? In fact, you're
oh no, but and all the national stuff is behind paywalls except right. for cable news,
and that's another factor. Yeah, even
and
yeah.
Newsmax, which comes to you free with your cable package and all that. You know, my sister has the app for Newsmax on her phone. But you know, I tell this story about my brother unfriending me on Facebook around 2017 because of, quote, all the liberal crap I post. Mm. Well, I post fact-checked articles because I'm a journalist from the New York Times and the Washington Post, some of which are my own articles. And I know they've been fact-checked because I've just been on the phone with the fact-checker for 3 days in a row. And when I'm trying to explain to my friends from home, this is legit news. This is, I mean, I told this story about one piece I had in the New York Times. It was an excerpt from Raising Lazarus, my previous book. The fact checker at the New York Times spent 3 days fact checking an excerpt, tracked down a homeless person with addiction who no longer had the same phone number, talked to him for an hour to confirm that what I wrote was exactly true. Talked to everybody in the piece. And I was telling my friend Joy, who thinks the media is just terrible liars and first of all, I'm pointing out that Joy, I'm the media too. You love me, right? And she said, yeah. And I explain about the fact checking. She says, well, who facts checks the fact checkers? And I'm like, Joy, facts are facts. There are things that happen. This young man I'm telling you about, like these things happened to him. And they called him, they tracked him down. And, you know, later she apologized because she kind of blew her temper with me, and I accepted her apology, but it was such news to her because she's been taught by her echo chamber that anybody in the New York Times or these national places where cities mainly where most of our news is manufactured, that they're lying to you. And no amount of me, her trusted friend since the age of five, telling her that that's not true seemed to penetrate. And that was sad.
That is sad. It's kind of writ large right across the country. Where does, and you investigate this a bit, where does this come from? We're a lot of us are in our silos, right? But
we are.
But for the people who are prone to conspiracy theories, and there's some in Urbana, right, that you talk about.
Many.
Shockingly. Where does that come from? How did we get there? I guess is what I'm what I'm asking. Where we're all we got from everybody who sat and watched Walter Cronkite to this. How did we get there?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the algorithms, and if you believe this, then you get more of that on your social media feeds. And we know that lies travel 6 times faster than the truth on social media, and we unleash, you know, all these digital products without regulating them at all. And so that, like I said, the lies move faster. And for people who can't access fact-based news because maybe they can't pay or get what the New York Times costs now per month, or maybe they don't have access in Urbana to a legit nonprofit, although they do, they just don't look at it. The Ohio Capital Journal actually does a great job out of Columbus. And we just get further and further siloed from each other. And we all know people who have fallen into these conspiracy traps. I mean, many of us have them in our family. And what I realized with all my interviews, going back home for 2 years, I would go back for about a week a month, is that the things that were happening in my family were mild compared to things that were happening with some of my old friends. And I interviewed an ex-boyfriend who I hadn't seen in 38 years. And he went from being the most liberal person I knew, and as he described it, an NPR tote bag carrying liberal, to someone who now gets his news 4 to 7 hours a day on a website out of Cyprus that is totally Russian propaganda. Mm. And he espouses, first of all, he's very, very angry. He becomes almost threatening to me. And as I'm following his story over the course of a year and a half, he becomes threatening to me. And after I cut off contact because I felt verbally and physically threatened by him, he emerges as the leader of the anti-Haitian immigrant community in Springfield, Ohio, which is where J.D. Vance and Donald Trump said they're eating the pets, they're eating the cats. And so suddenly he's on my TV screen, PBS NewsHour. He's a spokesman for it. And he becomes this public figure. And, he died in February. He didn't have health insurance, which he told me was a personal choice he made because he thought Obamacare was a scam on the middle class. And he got pneumonia and he waited too long to go to the hospital, even though they wouldn't have turned him away. And he died. And when I interviewed his daughter a couple months later, this is after I finished the book, she said, "The internet killed my dad." She described how his friends sort of turned their backs on him when he wasn't going to vote for the Democrats anymore. And, he had some legit concerns about the Iraq War and NAFTA and China joining the WTO. These were all heralded as these were going to be win-wins by the Democrats, who are now the party of millionaires. It's not like he didn't have kernels of truth in his new philosophy, but he went so dark. And he found community on the internet that his own community had sort of excommunicated him, including his Catholic church deacon, had made him feel really bad about not voting for Hillary. And he just found this hatred for Hillary on the internet, and it went from there. And if you talk to his daughter today, who's in her 30s, she would say, "The internet killed my dad." His beliefs killed him.
But the impetus you're saying is losing his community, is goes and searches for a new community. Is that part of the solution? I guess you building bridges is it, I guess we're
Building bridges, yeah. And also learning, I don't know how the friends that excommunicated him feel about that now. He became someone they didn't recognize. He became someone I didn't recognize. He became very, very angry. And he's a really smart person. And obviously he's my ex. It didn't end well with us, but I always respected his intellect, and I just wonder if we had had better tools to deal with our information ecosystem, and if that church deacon, for interest, for instance, had a better tool for how to keep him in the fold and respect some of what he's saying, which some of which was very true, whether it would have turned out differently for him. Because once he was sort of cast aside, it turned very dark for him. The last thing he posted on Twitter, I looked it up not long ago, and it was this thing espousing the great replacement theory.
Well, let's take a brief break. We'll come back. Much more, obviously, to discuss. So we're got discussing and a little late for the break. So let's take that. And when we come back, when we come back, Beth Macy, maybe have you read a brief passage from the book, something you would select. We're talking with Beth Macy, author previously of Factory Man, Dope Sick, and Raising Lazarus, longtime journalist. She's based in Virginia now, and the new book is a fascinating memoir. It's called Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with journalist and author Beth Macy. Her new book is called Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. So, Beth Macy, do you have a brief passage like to read from the
Sure, I
book?
was going to read something kind of fiery from the end, but I decided since it's early-ish in the interview, I'd go with something a tiny bit lighter, although it's not really that light. It's this moment when I'm preparing to interview my sister Cookie, the one who shouted at our mom's deathbed, and trying to figure out how we became so different. And so this is mostly a thing about my mom. My mom is the comic relief in this book because she's gritty and hilarious. And so this is a story that ends with a poem she wrote. So I say, No one in our family had much capacity to talk about feelings, not even mom and me. And we loved each other fiercely. But just as fiercely, mom and I also fought, usually over her criticisms of my clothes, hair, weight, or my frequency of visits home. She liked to waste time complaining about the length of my visits while I was visiting. If I complained about her critiques, I was accused of being too sensitive. We would cook away our fury or maybe hit a yard sale, and without ever discussing the thing that had landed us in this pickle, we'd make up, usually. One spring during college, we got into an argument on the phone. Afterwards, I wrote her a biting, over-the-top letter criticizing her lack of emotional support. Being a first-generation college student was often painful, and I sometimes took my insecurities out on mom. A few days later, I drove home for Easter. It was Good Friday, and she was working second shift when I arrived. On the kitchen table, she had thoughtfully left a large chocolate Easter egg to greet me, a pot of chili in the crock pot, and a poem she'd typed on her garage sale typewriter titled Easter Greeting to My Mean Daughter. And it went, "Your nasty letter really hurt, but over it I've got. I know you didn't mean it. You know I care a lot. And so at Easter time, let's try to nicen up a lot. Remember, I'm your super mom and the only one you got. And you are my super kid, like which there is no other. So happy Easter, Beth, from your bitchy, bitchy mother." And she was just like that. Like, no, it wasn't unusual. A lot of people in Ohio, we're not loquacious. It's not like Appalachia, where we have this great culture of storytelling. And that's one of the things I've noticed about the opioid crisis, because I spent most of my career in Appalachia. And people are willing to talk to you about things. But in Ohio, people are more buttoned up and they hold things closer to the vest. And we really didn't talk about feelings. And that's just a story. Like, I'm always looking when I write about a lot of dark, sad things in my career. And I'm always looking for those moments of lightness to interject. And because life isn't just all dark. And I'm always looking for those moments of humor in particular.
There's another passage that kind of stood out to me. Your mother had by this time had dementia. You sent Valentine's a card and a chocolate bar.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories. So
tell me that one.
so it was Valentine's Day. It was her last Valentine's Day. So it would have been November of 2020. And I sent her a card. And then I called on Friday to see if she had gotten it. Like, let's say Valentine's Day that year was earlier in the week. And so I call Friday and I say, "Hey, Mom, did you get my Valentine?" And she goes, "Huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I sent you a Valentine." And she goes, "Well, what did it look like?" And I said, "Well, it came in a manila envelope. There was a card inside, and there was a big bar of chocolate." And even as her mind and her memory was going, she was sharp enough to snap back, "Well, if you had sent me 2 bars of chocolate, I would have remembered." And that's just who she was. Like, she grew up scrappy in an abusive home. She continued to have to scrap until she married my stepdad in her 60s after my dad died. And then she had sort of this lovely kind of third act of her life where she didn't have to worry about, the heat being turned off in winter. And at one point she said, "You know, they say money isn't everything, but it's pretty nice." And she was just like, she had a million lines like that. And again, it's another example of a really, really smart person that just didn't have the kind of opportunities that I got to have.
A good example of, you keep trying, right? I'd like to talk about your attempts to build bridges, right? Your sister Cookie became evangelical. That's where she found refuge, right? You write that at a certain point, I guess she finds out that your son is going to marry his husband, and she starts quoting scriptures from Leviticus, etc. Big divide there, right?
So we're wrapping up this 2-hour interview, and it had gone really well. Our son had not long before announced that he was getting married to his fiance, or we put something on Facebook, and no one in my family except for one sister offered a single like on Facebook. Nobody texted congratulations or anything. And anyways, Cookie and I sat down. We had this pretty difficult interview over 2 hours, but it had gone so well, I thought, I'm just going to say what's on my heart. And I said, Cookie, I'm packing up my stuff. Cookie, Max thinks you don't like him because he's gay. And she quickly says, well, I don't like that he's gay, but I love him. And I said, Cookie, don't you want him to be happy? He's happy now. He's engaged to be married to this lovely person. She said, well, I thought I was happy too when I was running around with every Tom, Dick, and Harry. And I said, he's not running around with every Tom, Dick, and Harry. Like, she immediately went to that stereotype about gay people being loose or whatever. And then she started quoting scripture, Leviticus, and my pastor says, and I'm saying, like, he's marrying a really nice person with a great job and a big heart, and we should be happy for him. And she's saying, my pastor says he's going to hell. And I got so almost enraged by it. I could feel my face turning red. And I had done all this reporting on how to talk across the divide before I sat down with my sister and others in the community. And it just went out the window when it was my own kid. And I finally thought of Mr. Rogers, who said, use your words, Beth. And I said, Cookie, I'm getting mad. And if we're going to maintain, because we'd had a fun conversation of sorts, like at moments, we laughed a lot. We talked about mom. We talked about things that, like, our family was proud of, like mom and how hard she worked, and things we used to do together. We went fishing, we played cards, we loved food, recipes. We had done all these are like bridge building techniques. And but I said, Cookie, I'm getting really mad, and if we want to have a relationship, we shouldn't talk about this. And she said, And then eventually we had a little crack of empathy because she started asking me more about Max and what it was like. And I said, Cookie, he didn't come home for mom's last years of life because he had come out and he thought you'd say something mean to him. And she said, well, when he was little, did he get made fun of? And I said, oh, not when he was little, but when he went to kindergarten and he, started acting the way he had been accepted when he acted, he loved the Wizard of Oz as a little kid and wore these red ruby slippers. And she remembered that. She remembered that he was a little different from most kids. And she said, I remember that. And then she said, in a nice tone, did he get made fun of? And I said, not until he got to kindergarten. Then he got made fun of and he became kind of sullen and anxious because he couldn't be who he was, couldn't express himself. And she sat with that. And I don't think I'm going to ever convince her because these are her values. She's lived in this very conservative Christian nationalist church. They helped her when she was a single mom when others wouldn't. I mean, the family also helped her, but that's her value. And I was directly challenging her value. So there are things I could have done that might have been more reasonable, but one thing I could have done was I could have said, I did the best I could with what I knew at the time. What would you have done if you were in my shoes? I could have made myself vulnerable to her. I think vulnerability often opens a crack of empathy. And these are the kinds of questions I'm getting at all my book events that I've done since Paper Girl came out. I'm getting like, help, I have Thanksgiving dinner coming up with my relatives, and we can't talk about politics, or we'll be throwing mashed potatoes across the table from each other. What do I do? People are really struggling.
Yeah, I think the statistic, if I could find it here, one fifth of people report that they're now estranged from a family member because of politics. I would like to have you, let's end this part of the discussion on a happy note, I guess. You and your brother Tim had some success
We did.
bridging the
We
divide.
did.
This is the same brother who had unfriended you on Facebook because of your, quote, liberal news that you're sending out. How did you guys make a
Well,
bridge?
I started going back home once for a week, once a month, a couple years ago, 2.5 years ago. And just by spending time with each other, and again, this was, I did a lot of interviews with sociologists and counselors about how to do this. Talk to people at Brave Angels and other rural urban bridge initiative for advice. And the first thing they say is just get to know each other again as people. And I'm not sure I would have gone home very often had I not been like sort of self-assigned to do this project. So that's one thing. Just by spending more time together, we got to know each other as people. And then early on, my husband and I bought a little cabin up in the mountains here in Virginia. And one of the other pieces of advice was like, what are the things you celebrate in your family? I think I mentioned earlier that we love to fish. So I invited my brother up to see the cabin. You can stand in the creek. It's kind of a shallow creek, but it's got a big fishing hole like right across from where our cabin is. And I didn't remember how to set up a fishing rod, and our cabin came with a bunch of old fishing rods. And Tim brought me a tackle box, and we spent a very lovely weekend with him and his wife and me and my husband fishing and trying not to talk about politics. I mean, I just want to reestablish contact with my brother again. And at one point, I mean, we had a great time. He brought up politics once, and I didn't take the bait, not to throw a pun in there, but we were fishing and I didn't take the bait. And then later he leans over and he asks about our youngest child, Sasha, who is non-binary and is a professional musician, is in a great indie band called Palmyra, and they were having a great amount of success. They just released their first album, and he says, "Well, tell me about Sasha." He doesn't call him Sasha; he calls him is the name he was given at birth. "Tell me about him. How does he still date girls?" And he said it in such a caring tone that I just instinctively mirrored that back. And I said, "Well, yes, they are dating a woman, young woman right now, and I also mess up the pronouns." Just kind of gently putting him on alert that Sasha goes by they, them now. And then we listened to some Palmyra music together on Spotify, and he likes it. So he starts coming to Palmyra shows. He starts driving from Ohio to Virginia. He came to the album release party, 8 hours away from his home. I mean, he's a super fan of Palmyra on Facebook. He shows up. I mean, that's what it's about. We have to start showing up for people again. And does he agree with everything I write or say? I'm sure he doesn't. But we're siblings again, and it's been so rewarding. He's been so supportive of my kids. He came to my other son's wedding to his husband, and that's just a fantastic feeling.
Yeah, that is very hopeful. I guess you said elsewhere, give each other grace, spend time, right? Show up. That's
Spend
those are the
time.
keys.
Don't go immediately into your memorized talking points.
I want to talk. We have about 8 minutes or so left. I want to talk about have you addressed at least briefly this key question, right? Your question was, what happened to my hometown? So that's globalization, right? NAFTA, some of the other themes you write about in your other books, the opioid crisis certainly hit Urbana. I wonder if you could maybe we could center on you write about some young people, and kind of muse whether they're going to be able to survive, right? Maybe Silas. Silas really struck me. Tell me about Silas.
Great kid. So when I first started going back, I started casting about for a young me that could be a through line in the book. And I went to the schools, counselors, youth center, saying, "I'm looking for a promising poor kid. Like doesn't have to be an A plus student, but a decent student who's got some grit and who faces a lot of barriers, like a young me." And so I had already done the research to learn that we no longer allow poor kids to go to a 4-year college because the Pell Grant comes nowhere close to paying what it paid for me. Now it pays about 30% instead of 115%. And so I find this kid Silas, and I love his story immediately. Everybody suggested I profile Silas because he had been the drum major of the band, and I have been the president of the band, the marching band, and we know that when kids participate in things, like they do better. Like it keeps us out of trouble. It teaches us work ethic. It gives us these mentors that for kids like me and Silas, we didn't have in our own family. And so Silas becomes very bonded with his band director, as I was with mine. And but the remarkable thing about Silas is he's the perfect example of with a middle class being hollowed out, NAFTA, then the opioid crisis. He's lost a parent to a drug overdose. His other parent, who is also addicted, is in and out of prison, on probation when I meet her. And Silas, who is this bright light, super bright, isn't able to go to a 4-year school because of what I just described, but gets a double scholarship to go to a local community college. Now, that community college is in Springfield, Ohio. And by the time Silas is ready to go, his teachers have talked him into getting a welding certificate because that's not something AI can replace. And it's there are jobs like right now, you can get hired right now. So the first week, it's a summer term. He's just graduated from high school. It's the college is an hour away, but those scholarships only apply to tuition. They don't help them have transportation to get there. And people in cities don't think about it, but there's not a bus that's going to take him to Springfield or a train in rural Ohio. And the second day of class, his car breaks down. And not only that, but his mother gets in a car wreck separately and has a concussion and can't be left alone. So with all the caregiving, his dad is dead, all the caregiving falls to Silas, and he has to drop out the first week before he's even started. And his family is just dragging him down. And it's you see him over he gets back in school in the fall, but you see him over the course of a 10-month program struggle week in and week out to pay for gas to get there. He goes through five clunker cars. Eventually, he's able to get his certificate, I think four different jobs during the year. And that's another thing we could talk about is just how rough things are in the manufacturing workplace with when people don't show up for their work shifts, it falls upon those who do, who are mandated permanent overtime. And Silas struggled with that because he was a full-time student. And so he finally gets through and gets out of that home, and he's doing pretty well now. But it was just like by the grace of God. And he and I shared a stage in our hometown a couple days before the book came out for my event there. And I asked him in front of an audience, what made you so resilient? And he said, it's that because I didn't have the structure of a capable family, I was somehow able to create my own. With the band director, who he spent every lunch period with, sometimes crying, sometimes just getting advice, life advice, plotting his next move. Counselors who were willing to make sure that when he was couch surfing with friends his junior and senior year when he was homeless, that he could still get to school even when he was couch surfing in an adjacent district. Therapists who, helped him heal from some of the trauma that he experienced from being molested when he was staying with the caregiver when his parents were in prison. I mean, compared to me, my trauma would fit on Silas's pinky barely. He had so much more trauma than I. And when I would express my shock at the people who had led me to Silas, the teachers and the counselors who were his support group, they would say, "Well, that's who the new Beth Macy is." And I was just flabbergasted. And then I started to really do the data and the research to find that out that, oh yeah, like we are in a mental health crisis in this town and in many small towns in America. And like, that nine times multiplication of emergency mental health calls to 911 in the town since I left 40 years ago. I mean, that's hard data that proves that Silas isn't an outlier. And then I picked the right kid to write about. Tripling of foster care and all these things directly, opioid crisis, direct application to Silas's story. And he made it, but he's special.
Yeah. Many who don't, right? We just have
Many,
about
most don't.
Most don't. Yeah, we just have about a minute left. What can be done? What should be done? Government probably has a role here. What can be done to help people like Silas?
Well, certainly, and these Medicaid cuts that are coming down now, Medicaid has been the one thing since the Affordable Care Act went into being that has helped, especially men, young men in their 20s and 30s, who we know are disproportionately dying of overdose and deaths of despair. That's been the one way to get them mental health access, substance use disorder treatment. And with the cuts that are coming down the pike in that, we're going in the reverse direction. We're trying to bring manufacturing back, so our federal leaders tell us, but people in Urbana, every single employer I talk to can't get enough people to man the shifts. And so they're trucking in Haitian immigrants from Springfield. Well, now we're sending them away. It's like, and then we're telling lies about it and blaming it on trans people and immigrants who are supposedly stealing all of our healthcare dollars, which isn't true. And we've got to start advocating for ourselves. I'm really worried that our press freedoms are being eroded. You've got journalists being arrested in places like Chicago for filming ICE arrests of immigrants. We have got to elect better people. We've got to start patching back up this frayed fabric that is our country.
Well, we're out of time. Much more we could discuss. Read the book. We've been talking with Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, A Memoir of Home and Family in a Fractured America. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
It's one sky, many faces. Skywatcher Leo T here as we dive through the first third of October already. With blue skies and a breeze, seeing some big ferruginous hawks float overhead with the sun shining through their wings, and then rain in the night, heavy, then some snow up high. And the next day, blue skies, warm temps, a breeze ahead of more rain. As the day evolves to dusk and into darkness, we see the stars pop out in the summer triangle still overhead, and a little to the west, the half-lit waxing moon sharing the sky with Jupiter before gliding into a series of graceful pre-dawn pairings with Venus, Regulus, and some Earth shine. Saturn stands high enough now in the southeast for some good viewing as early as 10 p.m. Jupiter becomes the brightest point just after midnight as you look over to the east, and midweek offers prime viewing for the Andromeda galaxy. While early risers can chase the faint zodiac light glowing before sunrise, what's zodiac light? Well, it's dust in space, possibly from comets, planet formation, asteroids, or other cosmic collisions. Before dawn, look east for a fainter triangular space glow riding in the horizon. It's the zodiacal light, caused by sunlight reflecting off the dust in the inner solar system. It appears brightest in dark rural areas, but you can catch it here if you're lucky. The glow extends upward through Leo, centered around Regulus. It's a magical, subtle glow, and this from Stardate Magazine. You may have heard this, I don't know. You know that Brian May, you know, the guitar wizard from Queen, became an astrophysicist in 2007 after completing his thesis, started 30 years earlier? Pretty cool. Well, the subject was the tiniest members of the solar system. That's right, particles of dust that sometimes glow faintly in the night sky. The dust grains form a wide band that loops all the way around the sun. This dust is our zodiacal light. And at times of the year, when the viewing angle is right, we can pick up the ghostly glow, especially in September near the equinox and into October, which we're getting now. Yeah, great mix. Astrophysics and some of the best rock and roll there is. And checking out the vibe from above Terra Firma with KRCL and public radio listener. Skywatcher Leo T here. We're talking with Dan Frommel. And Dan is kind enough to have told me of an experience coming up, and then he completed it, of skydiving. Dan's done this before, but we're really interested here to find out what your impressions are of this.
Skydiving was an exhilarating experience, one that I feel like everyone should use or everyone should try. It's very fun. The people at Skydive Utah are great people and are really friendly, knowledgeable, answer all your questions. Get out there and jump.
So this is Twilla, correct?
That's correct. Eden.
So I asked you earlier, we were talking about this, could you sense the curve of the Earth?
Oh, 100%, you could sense the curve of the Earth. You could actually see it. It was amazing.
So this seems like to me a kind of a breakthrough in dimensions to be able to see the curve of the Earth.
Oh, it's amazing. It's definitely a different, whole different aspect of where you are in this universe.
How high were you when you jumped?
We were at 15.
15?
Yeah.
So as you went down, did you sense a change in perception, or what did you feel coming down?
I mean, it was mostly just the ground coming at you really fast.
You seem pretty calm about it, though.
It was, you know, second time, so it wasn't as exhilarating as the first, but still a great time.
You said something about feeling the pressure, maybe when you started getting lower?
Oh, yeah. Once you leave the plane and you feel the kind of the pressure building as you're falling, and then once you hit the ground, it just seems to explode in your head. You feel all the pressure, and your ears hurt after a while.
Okay, I'm going to have to go do that. And we were laughing a little bit, not laughing, but enjoying the fact that you told me your wife, Melissa, enjoyed it so much.
Oh, yes. She was very thrilled about it. I got her pictures. She has pictures of her with her face squished from all the forces. But, yeah, her and her daughter loved it. Her daughter was thinking about starting to train to be a jumper, tandem jumping trainee.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, wonderful. Well, thanks for your astronautical experience.
Thank you very much, Leo.
So get up high, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.